podcast. This episode is a very special one, released on what should be the weekend of the 2021 Donegal Rally. Fortunately, for the second year running, it's been called off due to the coronavirus situation, so still gives us time to look back at previous events. And one such event that we've kind of looked back on with fond memories, and you know, the more we dig into it, the more we realise how exciting and dramatic it was the 1999 event. So that's what we'll be focusing on for this episode. And we'll have guest appearances from Plum Tyndall and the event winner, James Cullen, later on in the episode. So with us as well tonight, we have Tommy Hayes.
Great to be back. It's been a while.
And Art McCarrick is here as well.
Greetings.
I suppose, just to kind of get a picture of where Irish rallying was at the time. I mean, it was kind of in a bit of a state of transition from the old guard, Bertie and Austin and all, and you had the new guys coming in, like Derek McGarity, Andrew Nisbet and stuff. Like, it was an extremely competitive time.
Oh, hugely. And like, you look at the guys that were, arguably the guys that were coming up were even in better machinery in some cases, or fellas that had been around the national championship for years and just decided internationals is where they wanted to be now, like the likes of, you know, Boland and all of those were always in the best of machinery every year. Yeah, you would say 99-2000 was kind of the peak of that. The fellas that could get the first World Rally cars were getting them. The fellas that could get the best Group A cars had them. But outside of the top 10, there really wasn't that much. It was kind of mad when you look back on it now with a more critical eye, you'd go, maybe there wasn't that much strength and depth, but the top 10 was always unbelievably strong, or it seemed that way anyway.
I think we were just on the cusp, really, of the World Rally Car era making itself known in Ireland, because to an extent, there was always a certain number of competitors who were always in the very best machinery, and they set the bar for what every other competitor should have. And really, you'd have to say the likes of Bertie Fisher and Austin McHale, in terms of their preparation and how they presented themselves, they were the ones that set the bar. And 1999 was really the first time that we'd seen other competitors finally come up to that level, you know, in terms of machinery. Yeah. And it doesn't take anything away from the talent of the guys, the likes of Bertie and Austin, but guys now were able to get up to that point where, okay, now we can give these guys a race. And I think that's what made Donegal 99 the fascinating event that it was, because it was coming towards the end of an era for the Group A cars. World Rally cars were there, but they were, the only World Rally car we were seeing was an Escort WRC, which was an evolution of sorts of the Group A Cosworth.
Yeah. Like for most of the 90s, McHale wasn't even in the most up-to-date car. I'd say for all of the 90s, actually. Early on, he was in the M3.
Yeah, he got the 185 in 97.
It was an old car then, and he was still plugging away with it in 99, having won two back-to-back championships in it. So, yeah, like, that was always going to run out just because of where that car stopped, and the Subaru was continuously, like, Fisher's silver car that year in 98 and 99 was probably the most advanced Group A Subaru the ProDrive ever put out to a privateer.
Yeah.
So, you know, Toyota had kind of stopped unless they were selling stuff out of an illegal skunk works out the back.
That was
kind of as far as that was going to go. So that was always going to trail off.
It's interesting to note, I suppose, the machinery that was around, as you mentioned, the Escorts. While they were an evolution of the Cosworth, you know, there seemed to be varying specs of them, even within this event. You had Stephen Murphy's car, which was on an Irish Ridge for whatever reason. Beautiful livery. The one thing we'll get to in a minute as well is the liveries and the Swanses at the time. They're kind of iconic. They seem to add to the whole thing as well. But Stephen Murphy's car seemed to be one level. Then you had Eamon Boland's car, the Black Hertz Escort, which was probably one of my top five cars in Irish rallying ever. And Frank Maher's, which was, I think, either one of the last or the last Escort WRC built by
him. It was the last one, because he finished second with Kankinen driving, and Petter Solberg ran it in Sweden.
99, he did,
Because they didn't have enough focuses.
It was the last or second last, because I think it was originally the last one. And who absolutely...
Bruno Thierry.
Obliterated one in New Zealand the year before. They had to build an extra one then for someone to use in GB. I think it was originally meant to be the last one, and then it was the second last one, I think. But it was very fresh.
Waited that had been from a helping hand from a certain Tipperary preparation man working in a sport at the time.
I've no doubt.
And to be fair, anyone who's heard one, the escorts, what a sound those things made. They were just like the Cosworths kind of could sound a little bit flat, but the WRC cow, they were just the most angry, loud, aggressive sounding thing. Like it's worth looking up on YouTube of some of the great clips from the time from Jordan McCarron there, where they show you can really see and hear the drama from the escorts, you know. And looking at it's just interesting to note that on the continent, the WRC cars from the likes of Toyota and Subaru were prevalent at that point, but yet over here they hadn't quite arrived yet. Now Nisbet did get a 2-door WRC car at the end of 99, but I remember reading that he tried to get a Corolla for 99 and was told PFO essentially, which is why he made the switch to that lovely X-Pro car Subaru he had. And then Mikhail was due to get one. He did actually get one in 99. It was after the Donegal, and I think he had it for the Stone Throwers or the Galway Summer or something like that.
Yeah.
And she was like, again, to the untrained eye or ear, a WRC car is a WRC car, but the difference between Mikhail's first Corolla to the second one he had was gigantic as well, you know.
But 99 was also the last year of, you know, probably you could draw a line after 99 and go, okay, the Celtic Tiger lunacy started the year after. You know, where fellas could get whatever they wanted, or that just, like, there was all the chat at the time that Greer was going to try and get a Group A Evo 6 from Rally Art, and that was never going to happen. And there was all of these, that was like the things you couldn't get. And like 3 or 4 years later, you can get whatever the hell you wanted if you had
the money. There was fellas lending over with Fabias and accents and all sorts of.
Imagine, like, just to have something different. Like, they could just have an S9. Exactly, they could have an S9 if they wanted. Like, now, sure, we'll get a Fabia.
Yeah.
Rallying was never cheap, but to be honest, the fact that this was still within the Group A era, you could still have a car competitively and run it, okay, reasonably. I suppose it's all relative, you know, in what you're talking about spending, but compared to when the World Rally Carrier really, when the floodgates opened, this was kind of the last time maybe where a privateer hiring a car from the likes of Kenny McKinstry could stand a chance, you know, of winning the rally, because they were still a fairly level spec.
I think this was the end of the kind of four-door Impreza's dominance. It had been so, you know, prominent in Bertie's hands all the way up along. All of a sudden, 99, everyone seemed to have one. You know, he was kind of flying the flag there himself for a long, long time. And then just looking at the entry for Donegal, I mean, this is like basically a who's who of Irish rallying for the last, you know, for probably the history of the sport in this country, really, when you think about all the names that we class as our heroes. So Nisbet was first on the road owing to his victory the previous year. You had Bertie in second, Mikhail was number three, Ian Greer four, all Group A cars there. Maher was the first WRC car, number five, followed by Damon Boland. Stephen Murphy didn't actually show for whatever reason. And James Cullen was at number seven, winner in 1991. Derek McGarty, this is his first year, Derek's first year kind of in the top flight, shall we say, of the sport over here.
Like, just looking back at that now, it's a bit like, you know, when you started doing these podcasts, you know, the 2001 WRC, looking back, I'm just looking there now, seven of the top eight are former Tarmac champions.
Yeah. Exactly, they were either champions already at this point, or would go on to be champions. Yeah,
and the only one that wasn't is the man who ended up winning the rally this weekend.
Yeah, it's looking at it now, and again, you know, the benefit of hindsight, it's amazing. But back then, would it have seemed as special as it seems to us now? I'm not sure. But then again, the crowds might on the weekend would kind of tell their own story. You know,
I don't know, because like if you look at we were at round four. Donegal, you know, has become, since Killarney moved to its May Bank holiday date, it's traditionally been the fourth round of the championship. And, you know, you'd enough there to build up a bit of hype about the event, because the first round, Ian Greer ran Bertie Fisher extremely close in Galway, and Bertie got ahead. Then in Circuit of Ireland, you had that massive battle between Nesbitt and Fisher, which, you know, went for 4 days up and down the country. Round three in Killarney, you had the big comeback from Frank Maher back out of the wilderness, you know, in a World Rally car with little or no seat time to race Ian Greer, who ultimately won the rally. So, like, there was enough there to satisfy so many, you know, fan bases as well, you know.
Each event had a big story. Yeah. A lot of them were different.
And here, you know, you have everyone all in the ultimate rally playground on tarmac in Ireland, yeah, in the very best machinery. Everyone, there was no hiding. Everyone was up against their peers, and you had the best machinery, each and every one of them did.
I think Blum put it the most in his own beautiful way. If you listen to the intro of the programme with Saul Water, which you came playing in the background, you could find a better playground for the rugged road races, was how he put it. And, you know, just the chills go through your neck straight away here and that, you know. And he's right. You know, Donegal, like, we just, you know, to get withdrawal symptoms if you don't go, and it's even harder for people these last couple of years when it's not on. So hopefully it'll return to normality next year. The one thing that always just gets me going is flying up there on a Thursday afternoon up through Barnsmore Gap, you know, the tune's going and heading for scrutiny or whatever, and they're, you know, buzzing. Yep. Like, just it's a different, as was mentioned in the RPM program, which we get to a little bit further on, Letterkenny doesn't just allow the route, you know, it actually embraces it. It doesn't just tolerate it. So
I suppose for any of our listeners, I suppose, that are from other lands other than Ireland and the UK, it is something that you just, it's very hard to describe.
Yeah, like if someone was listening in a European context, you might say Ypres isn't a million miles away, in that kind of uses roughly the same stages every year, or at least in the last number of years, there hasn't been too much variation. It's all based out of one town, essentially. And yeah, the 3 days each have a kind of generally a distinct flavour to them. So that's probably the best way of describing it to a neutral.
Even, and every so often, the weather even plays ball. You know, so
massive.
Massive.
Donegal itself as a county is a fantastic place to even to visit on a non-rally weekend or whatever. It's a wonderful part of the country. Yeah, people are so friendly up there, but the whole county seems to just go mad that entire weekend. It's you have to be there to experience.
But sure, there's someone from every parish in the county competing. Like, you know, you look down through the entry list in Donegal, and fellas from Donegal town, Ardra, up to Burtonport, you know, Glenswilly, you know, all over the county. Like, it's mad.
Yeah,
with that very much in mind, this event, you know, James Cullen finally out in a car that really was the equal of his peers, you know. You'd have to imagine that there would be, obviously there's a level of expectation with someone of that quality, but I mean, okay, now we're going to see it. This is going to be.
I had one Cavan in the run up too, against the strong entry there, after having not done anything since the previous year. So he'd only done really, I think, one rally in the car.
Yeah,
Cavan.
Interesting, from McGarrity as well, just looking at the two cars are very close in terms of their ridges. McGarrity was P135 XPW and Cullen's 136. Why did McGarrity's car have the facelift front? Can anyone?
Is it because it was French? It was in France. And Simon John Joseph had it, but I don't know why it had that facelift front.
Half score for art. Tommy, do you want to take a stab at the rest of the...
I'm going to... Well, obviously, the Seaman Jean-Joseph link with it being run in France, but also was there Subaru France backing on the car that it had to be facelifted?
Was that model of Impreza only sold in France or something with that weird
facelift? The reason why McGarrity's car had the facelift front, correct, it was Seaman Jean-Joseph's old car, but there was some strange rule in France where you couldn't have any car that was newer than 2 years old. It was just at the time, I think, because then the following year, Max Rempo had basically brand new two-door there. But I think for marketing reasons, as you alluded to there, Tommy, with Super Friends, they put the facelift front in it.
Yet you could create your own four-wheel drive Zara and rally it there and nowhere else in the world.
Well, that was because it was a French car.
Yeah.
So, French team. Like, yeah. The facelift in front then would have had to have been homologated. Surely.
just like those brake ducts on that S10 you were talking about before.
Yeah.
Just like multiple infringements.
I would imagine the French would, if that car was getting away with it in France, you know, they might be a bit more by the book, maybe. But yeah, that's it. Jeez, I never knew that. Yeah. I always wondered it.
Well, they did.
I could be wrong there, no, but if I'm right, at least it's an interesting. But
that is interesting. Like interesting to a very useless fact. Like interesting to, you know, that's very small select people. But
I'm sure some people have actually switched off the podcast after hearing that. No, they can't.
Oh God! Level of phones Penelope. Have been thrown across the room and discussed.
Fisher, definitely this year with a point to prove. Everyone talks about the silver car being the iconic car, and the year before was not what you would say what we normally saw with Bertie.
No.
This year was a massive return to form, but the stakes were higher this year.
Definitely. I mean, as you said, that car is probably one of the most closely associated with the Fisher name, but he had no look in that car. As you said, he'd won Galway and the circuit battle was fantastic with Nisbet as well. But, you know, we can talk about it now because it's so long ago, but I'm sure everyone knows at this stage that what happened in the Cork 20 this year, where Fisher went off the road while on course for the title. So, you know, and that was it. That was this. We were almost at the end of Bertie's rallying career here at this point. But age hadn't diminished his pace by any means. I mean, watching Fisher on the stage still gives me shivers. Like, it's just watching him come into junctions and stuff. He's just so at one with the car. It's fantastic.
Under braking, people used to say that's where the real time he used to make, just on under braking, knowing exactly where the biting point and to carry that speed through the corner. Just phenomenal talent.
This was his sixth year in a Group A Impreza. So he was well familiar with it by now. Like,
yeah.
I feel so lucky to actually have seen us go up the gap in 94 in the blue one.
The very first one.
First stage.
With the big restrictor.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was, you could hear it idling inside in Parc Fermé. And then we went up, we were down really early. And this is in the days, obviously, I know we're going on a slight tangent here. These are the days pre-Facebook, you know, internet forums where, you know, you get leaked what's going to be there. You either saw it in motoring news or maybe in a small bit of auto sport, or you just happened to find out 'twas there. Someone told you, you know, and this was just like something of a different world. And now you couldn't move for them, Donegal.
Yeah. Bertie's, he obviously had a very long association with ProDrive from DM3 days and then back into the Subaru again after the Cosworth and whatever. As I said there earlier on, this was just a nice intersection between the established guys and the new guys coming in. And as we said, with so many, you know, past and future champions here, one event, it was reminiscent of the peak of the WRC as well, which is around, funny enough, around the same time in our eyes. But anyway,
yeah.
Again, we were all young kids whenever this was going on. We were so impressionable. The cars were spectacular. Deliveries were, you know, I imagine, like, I always love looking at European rallies and seeing the different liveries and the cars and whatever. I imagine someone from Europe looking at this would think exactly the same because everything looks so well presented. And of course, this leads us nicely into the whole RPM factor, which is absolutely at their very, very best, very top of their game at this point. Like, in the first 5 minutes of this program, we had Hey Boy, Hey Girl by the Chemical Brothers and Saltwater, which you can't play. I mean, come on, like,
yeah,
like, how both of those songs are 22 and a bit years old now is beyond me.
Frightening. Yeah, I still probably listen to them most weeks, like, do you know what I mean? Yeah. They're, you know, it is just
well, I instantly, anytime I hear that Saltwater Chicane thing, invariably whenever it pops up on Spotify or something.
Donegal 99.
Straight away, Donegal 99 in your head.
Did we talk about this already? Did we?
We created a whole playlist about this. Yeah.
We did create a whole playlist about it, but did we decide Donegal 99? I think I might have picked it as my favorite RPM ever at some point.
I did as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And please go on and dig it out if you haven't watched it already, or just go and watch it again, because it's just everyone's at the top of their game. RPM. This is you know, if you want to show someone the magic of RPM, this is the one you show them, you know. But
it's just like you were just saying there about how this kind of parallels the 2001 WRC. These days, back then when you had Fisher, Maher, Cullen, McKinstry, you know, obviously not in this event, you used to get as excited about these events as you did about, as we would now about maybe a WRC event. And that wasn't just us. I used to see guys going, and they were going down there, like they were going down to see the fastest guys in the world. That's the way they looked at it, because the RPM footage framed it that way.
Mm. And it was arguably as well, again, going into the 2000s, 2001, 2002, as cars inevitably got quicker. It was probably the last year a lot of stages in Donegal ran in a clean and or traditional format, as in there wasn't a whole lot of chicanes, or certainly a lot less than there would be now on some of them.
Yeah.
You know, tires back then aren't what they are now.
Suspension is a big thing.
Suspension, like, you look at
nobody has any travel. Look at Greer's car over the Letterleaf.
Greer's car over the jump Legland Bridge, and like if the wheel moves that much, oh man, it's a hard landing.
Like the onboards with Fisher as well, like he's fighting the car all the time,
and
one
hand on the wheel all the way. And Ian Greer did a lot of one-handed stuff as well.
And I
think it might have been the last year in the international, one of the last years, probably 2000 as well, actually, that Kindrum would have been used, because the road got widened. I think it got used in the harvest then a couple of years later. But it was peak Donegal, if that's not too grand an expression to come up with.
It is iconic. I mean, looking at the stages, Breen and Letter League, Atlantic Drive, Glen, Kindrum, as you said, Fannett, Knockalla, Mallin Head even was used, which hasn't... when was the last time that ran again? That's a fantastic bit of road.
Yeah, Mallin hasn't run in a while. There's an in-car of James Cullen on Breena. In reverse to how it's been run in recent years.
So fast.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it is so fast.
And he's here travelling like...
very, very vague notes.
Yeah.
He absolutely knows where he's going, but my God, it is some peddling.
He nearly goes off as well, and his notes, once a KLF, he comes in definitely 20 miles an hour too fast. He got around it.
At the bridge. Absolutely
barreling into it. The bridge. Ellen Morgan goes, no drama, and away he went.
He was on a mission that Friday afternoon, because obviously stage one was where it all happened.
Stage one.
Right out of the blocks.
Before we get too far into Tommy, do you have anything to note on the entry?
On the entry, I suppose we had a few guys that they stick out to us now a little bit. Niall McShay was there in a Saxo. He'd started out the year doing the Super 106 Cup with the likes of Mark Fisher and Rory Galligan and the guys in the UK. But as he alluded to on our own podcast, he wanted one of these and got a go in it. Who else was there? Mark Fisher turned up in a Pro Drive Group N Impreza, which was going to be interesting. It was his first four-wheel drive event that we were aware of at the time, but he was having a good year in the UK doing the 106 Cup. It was, in terms of entries other than that,
Paul Nagel did it.
He did? Who was Paul?
Co-driving for Kieran O'Neill.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of other interesting navigators there. Stella Biles, navigating for Natalie Barrett, and you were talking about the Peugeot thing there. She was heavily involved in that at the time. Nigel Fraser was navigating for Philip Shaw. Nigel Fraser was Austin Fraser's son, who would have...
Can we just go back to the Kieran O'Neill thing there for a second? Kieran O'Neill was like
Yeah, how can we glass over Kieran O'Neill?
Yeah. The muster boy of RPM.
Kieran, yeah, he was. He could have got his own RPM DVD on his own.
He could have. Jesus, non-stop drama.
Notwithstanding the Group A cars, B13, which obviously is just a slightly non-homologated gearboxes and things in Iskar Cosworth, there was a good entry, you know, down the field outside of the
it was the class 20 of the day.
Structure is all over the place, isn't it? I tried to make sense of it. I just gave up after about 10 minutes because once I got past A8 and N4, the rest of it is a little bit confusing. But anyway,
Don Buckley as well, also the very talented Scottish driver, now preparation expert. He was over in a guy called Bobby King in Scotland. He's prepared these four-wheel drive Porsches, and Don Buckley was out in that car. And spectacular, I suppose, is one word for it.
That car was driven, I would say, by the most amount of champions of various degrees. Kenny McKinstry drove it.
Jimmy?
I'm fairly certain Derek McGarrity did a rally. Jimmy McRae definitely did. Paul Harris did. Roy White did.
Did Roy drive that car?
Roy White did Lurgan Park in it one year. Yeah, come on.
Not a pleasant thing around Lurgan Park.
Oh my God, no! But Buckley did it in it as well. One year, lots of really really quick talented guys drove it, but it looked like a bear of a yoke to drive.
Yeah. Speaking of Paul Harris, can somebody explain to me what the hell is going on with that car? It's a two-door narrow track Group A thing.
He wrecked the Legacy in, I want to say, Wexford in 98. I stand to be corrected on that. Someone correct me. And it was reshelled by Auto Sportif. So it still had the Legacy reg.
Yeah.
It was reshelled into an Impreza shell by, I'm fairly certain it was Auto Sportif. And it was ready for the harvest that year in 98, which I think he won. And then he continued to have that car and develop it up to around 2003.
Yeah,
had a huge off on Port Lake one year, and it didn't do a whole lot after that. I don't know where it went. It was probably re-regged and sold on or something.
Yeah.
But that was the story behind it. The Legacy, which was a proper ex-Pro Drive one. It was one of the
LMX cars.
I put good money it was Auto Sportif that reshelled at that time, and that's why it looked and sounded a little bit weird. It was kind of Legacy bits with Impreza bits kind of banged into an Impreza. So
what's an allegation?
What is an allegation?
Who cares?
Yeah, because he was Paul Harris was pretty much impossible to beat in national events around that time, like late 99, all
quick driver. 2000.
Super quick driver, yeah.
Right, stage one. And before anything starts, we've got a couple of interesting spectators on the ditch.
That's Martin Petter.
Yeah, and to a friend of ours, Brian, actually pointed out that was Petter or Joe. They called out Malcolm in the programme. Obviously, Petter wouldn't have been all that well known back then. But there he was, big blandy hitting him. Probably not a word of English. And so I wonder what he made of spectating Donegal in 99. I tell you what, man, if I had a time machine, I'd love to go back there and just see, just generally the buzz at the time must have been just crazy. You see, even the crowd at the start ramp inside in the middle of Kenny, and the start ramp is barely wide enough for the cars coming off it. Do you know what I mean? The top cars, like, but Jesus, looked unreal now. But massive drama in stage one.
Yeah, I suppose winner of the previous year and winner in 96, Andrew Nisbet, was already off. And that was in the RPM footage where it was actually Bertie Fisher came on it with the onboard camera, and it looks like it was like the car was sitting kind of half beached on a bank or a ditch, kind of half down in a dike or something, was it?
How he described it was that he just basically touched the handbrake, and I don't know, did it catch a bit of grab
as the drift guys would say, he over rotated.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Drift King. Thank you.
Yeah.
See you on the Touge.
See you in Toge. You in the Tog. and Fisher passed him then, and his handbrake was getting stuck on or something, because you could hear Rory Kinnerty.
That's not something you want in a Group A Subaru. Accelerating away.
Probably tricky enough to
The diff, as it was. The diffs would love that.
Cullen clipped, he was actually catching Eamon at one point on the stage, got distracted, clipped the rock and punctured. He then got passed out again by Nisbet and subsequently McGarrity, so he'd lost well over a minute, I think, on the stage. And then the end of the stage, then there was a random weight check, and Greer's car was found to be underweight. So everything was happening at one minute.
12 kilos.
12 kilos. I mean, that's hardly intentional. When you think about it, like, do you know, that's...
Is it a wheel and a jack?
Is it, do you know, exactly, like, that is... Is there any tolerance there? You might be closer to the side of it than we are, but was there any tolerance allowed for, or was that it?
Not really. Like, you would say anything over 10 kilos is sizable enough. I think, like, the car has a weight, so that's it.
Was 1230 in Group A the homologation?
I think so, and you know, maybe how they clarify it a bit now is the car has a weight, and then the car and crew has a weight as well, so the car has a weight for homologation purposes, and sometimes it can be a bit different for car and crew.
How can they prove the fuel then as well, you see? How can they prove that whatever might it say in the gauge is actually what's in the tank? Do you know, did they take that into account? Or?
God knows. But I don't know how they do that. Like, yeah, what's the weight? Because if it's a spot check at the end of the stage, you know, like if you knock a bumper off during the stage, then surely it's quite obvious.
If you get a puncture, half your tire is gone, do you know? So
and your front wing gone with it.
Exactly. So
there must have been something. It may not have been as, you know, simple as a spot check just out the road. Maybe it was, but clearly they thought at the time that this was acceptable, and all he could do was appeal and continue to run under appeal. And obviously, the whole thing rumbled on for, I think, until October that year.
I think at this point, guys, what we'll do is rather than us trying to look back and make a hames of trying to tell the story, let's leave it to the professionals. So we'll hear now from Plum Tindall, and following that, James Cullen, who'll tell their tales of the rally.
Nice to look back and to remember just what an outstanding time it was in Irish rallying.
Yeah, it was an amazing period. You know, we were kind of, everyone seemed to be kind of getting back out there and in top machinery, it seemed.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was looking at a full onboard of James Cullen on the Letter League stage, the whole length of it from that era. And it was such a different time. I mean, there was no paddle change or sequential boxes or anything like that. They were, you know, you're going through the old gate change gearbox and you're fighting away the wheel. Obviously, the suspension wasn't so good. The cars were jumping all over the place. And really, you know, it makes you think, did the drivers have to do more work in those days than they do now? I don't know. It's a higher speed, of course, now, but it was hard work.
Absolutely. And with some of the names out on show at the time, the likes of Bertie Fisher and Austin McHale, Ian Greer, no one would give an inch to each other. But when you look back, Plum, how does 1999 stand out for you as a year of covering Irish rallying?
Very interesting year because, you know, one of the most underestimated drivers I feel in over the years has been actually Ian Greer. And, of course, he was champion that year and he had that brilliant run in Donegal, albeit overshadowed by the disqualification for the car being underweight. Now, I'm sort of putting the end of the story at the beginning in a sense, but I know that they went to appeal that in the Motorsport Ireland, or the RIAC as it was then. And in fact, their appeal was thrown out because the car had been entered under the sponsor, Toronto DePaul, and they hadn't got an entrance license. So they never even heard the appeal. So they probably didn't get a decent opportunity to defend themselves.
There was a lot going on that year, though. I mean, Ian Greer had found himself to be on the pace, having knocked on the door a bit in the previous year in a slightly older league. But you had people coming back into the sport, and you had some epic battles in the run-in to Donegal on the previous events.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't sort of recall them just in great detail now, but I know coming to Donegal, I mean, it was a super entry. And we were about three quarters way through the first stage with the RPM crew. And of course, we were shattered because, no Nesbitt turned up. He was already on his side in a ditch at that point. And then Cullen came through with a puncture. So already two of the star runners seemed to be out of the rally. But of course, as we found out, that was far from the case.
Absolutely. And when you look back, and I suppose it's difficult to say, you know, we're looking back 22 years, but it feels like only yesterday. What were there any expectations for this particular Donegal? Like, was there a feeling that this one could be a bit special?
Well, I mean, Cullen was rent a car, and he really, you wouldn't have put a lot of money on Cullen, although, you know, brilliant driver and always good in Donegal. But for the outright win against Fisher in the Subaru Legacy and Nesbitt and Greer, who was very much in form at that year, you had McGarrity, you had Maher was a bit of a last-minute entry in the very latest Ford Escort WRC. Or was it W? It wouldn't have been WRC, but it was the very latest Ford Escort. So Cullen, you know, he would have been thereabouts, but you didn't really expect him, I don't think, to win.
Like, as you just alluded to, the events of the first stage, as they were portrayed on the RPM TV program, the drama that was unfolding, and I mean, even what we often remark upon is who witnessed it. People in the crowd were people like Petter Solberg and Malcolm Wilson looking on.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, we would always have driven over those stages to recce our points for the filming. And so knew the stage pretty well. And particularly kind of remember the corner where Nesbitt went off, because a very slow corner, it was a very slow left-hander. And he just was very unfortunate. He got stuck right down in the ditch and it took a long time to get him out. So that was a pretty major setback.
The battle that ensued following Nesbitt's time loss and James Cullen's puncture on that first stage.
Yeah.
It was obviously a repeat of what we'd seen in Galway between Bertie and Ian. Did you foresee this being a real tight one, you know, between the two guys?
Well, yeah, but I mean, Nesbitt came out of that stage in 113th place. You know, really, even the magic of Nesbitt and Donegal, that was a tall ask. And I think Cullen came out in about 21st place or something like that. So, there was an enormous amount of ground to make up. And the guys they were playing with, they weren't the sort of guys that if you were taking seconds off these guys, you were doing well. But with that sort of deficit. But then, of course, Donegal is traditionally now the longest rally in Ireland after the demise of the longer circuit. Donegal is the big one. And they stuck steadfastly to keeping it a three-day event. At times, you wondered, was that the right decision? Was it affecting the entries? But of course, in hindsight, it was very much the right decision. And it makes it such a special event, even to this day, where it runs.
In that battle for the lead, while Nesbitt and James were working their way back up through the field, Bertie and Ian were obviously conducting their fight. But Bertie was obviously on a bit of a mission in 1999. He didn't have a great year before in 1998. Did you sense that he had a point to prove this year?
Well, yeah, he got that beautiful new car, which was which was a WRC car in disguise, really. The pro-driven car, we used to call it the Silver Dream Racer. And it really was a dream. It was a beautiful looking car, but it wasn't really bringing the results. It hadn't brought the results that he'd hoped for. And of course, he was under pressure to really do well in Donegal. And of course, he did do very well. But again, it was the famous Fannett Peninsula, which always seemed to be his bogey area, that caught him out. Not Fannett stage this time, but the one before it. So he lost a lot of time there. But he wasn't the luckiest always in Donegal.
No, you alluded to that in the interview, and he took it in good humour, to give him his credit. But the Fannett Peninsula never seemed to be quite kind to him, unfortunately.
No, not really. And, you talk about the interviews in Milford. Over the years, there's been some very hairy ones, because I always had the policy that RPM told it warts and all. And we would praise when we felt praise was due, and we would criticise when maybe it wasn't, and we'd also try and probe when there was a bit of a hidden story. So I suppose I wasn't always the most popular with the drivers. We ended up all very good friends. And but that particular interview was a wee bit edgy, because obviously Fannett was coming up, and he was under big pressure, and he didn't want to be reminded about Fannett. He didn't want to in any way undermine his confidence going into those stages. So I think that's why the answers were a little bit clipped, a little bit sort of reserved from Bertie.
As an event where, I suppose, for the likes of, when we list off the names like Bertie Fisher, Austin McHale, Frank Maher, James Cullen, to see all these guys racing against their peers in what they all finally seem to be in equivalent machinery, did it stand out in that regard too, that they finally all seem to be on an even playing field?
Well, you see, we were into pace notes now, which made it much more even, because there was always, up prior to that, you always had the problem about local knowledge. And they now, pace notes were legal again. They had been legal originally in Donegal, then the Motorsport Ireland insisted that they dropped them, but now they fought back and pace notes became illegal. And it did even up things a lot. When the British drivers, or the British championship contenders, the Scottish drivers came to Ireland, they were always wary of going to certain territories. Jimmy McRae was very wary of going to Donegal, because he knew that other drivers would be quicker than him there. Never worried about the circuit, because there was time enough to sort it out. He reckoned he could allow people to be quick in their own territories, but overall he would be there and he would scoop it up. But there were Donegal specialists, Galway specialists, Killarney specialists. So the pace note things much evened it up.
Was there a feeling that with the onset of World Rally Car technology, like Frank Maher and Eamon Boland had the World Rally Car escorts, but a number of the drivers had Civicas and Impreza 555s, that we were beginning to see the end of an era?
I suppose so, yes. But we kind of look back on things with a bit rose-tinted glasses. I mean, Irish rallying was always the few that could afford it or could muster together the sponsorship or whatever it was. So it didn't change that much until we got into the Celtic Tiger years, when just so many people had so much money. And, they had the extraordinary thing of the more World Rally cars in Ireland than anywhere else in Europe. So that hadn't come then. But what was happening now was that the home builder couldn't survive. You had to go to the Pro Drives or the Malcolm Wilson. So that was beginning to happen. The cars were becoming so specialist. you had amazing guys like Kenny McKinstry who could fettle Subarus at much less cost than sending them back to ProDrive either every time. But of course, sometimes they had to pay the penalty of reliability, because ProDrive would always throw new stuff out on each car and that sort of thing. But you know, you were getting into the point where you couldn't go and buy a rally car and run it yourself. You had to have your ProDrive engineer there or your M Sport engineer there, and that was a whole different ballgame.
Absolutely, it was taking it to a different level. It was already at. Irish Rally's always been at a high level, but it just kept stepping up all the time, and Donegal was never an exception. Any interesting tales of this event in 1999 that we may not be aware of? Events that may have occurred before, during, and after the event?
The lightweight problem was really the big talking point of that year. And it was a pity because you know, definitely overshadowed Ian Greer's performance, and it was hanging over him for virtually the whole rally. An interesting little side story was Paul Harris was also excluded for his car being lightweight, and Paul was being co-driven by Don Wilmot, and Don Wilmot had just been appointed as the coordinator for the Tarmac Championship. And this was going to be his last co-driving rally because he had to seem to be right down the middle, not to be biased towards any one competitor. But of course, he was caught a little bit embarrassingly in a car that was deemed to be illegal. And he was a very good friend of mine. And, you know, a little devil got into me, and we interviewed him in front of the Mount Errigal Hotel. And we're saying, congratulations on becoming the coordinator. Oh, thank you very much, I said. And I said, Don, you know, you're driving with Paul Harris this weekend. Is it not a bit embarrassing that the new coordinator has been found to be blatantly illegal? And it was the funniest thing. I mean, his eyes were darting, help, help, you know, what am I going to say to this guy? You know, how do I get out of this one? You know, and we switched off the camera and he said, plum, you fecker, you know, you really caught me there. That's a little aside that I'll always remember. The other thing was the extraordinary exhibition that Don Buckley put on in the Porsche 911. He was over, obviously, from Scotland, and he drove the absolute wheels off that car until eventually he put it off. I think it might have been on the Glen stage, but he was spectacular to watch, you know.
Don Buckley's performance is something and that kind of slipped under the radar, and so many performances probably went unnoticed, like the likes of Niall McShay and the Saxo. There was so much going on in this rally. That's one of the reasons why this RPM and this rally to us all was stuck out. Was it a struggle to fit everything into the program of 45 minutes? Because this was obviously before you had the national program and the international program.
It was always a problem because also, I mean, our main source was UTV because they commanded the biggest viewers. You know, as time went by, they slipped more and more adverts in the program. And, they went a half-hour slot, started out about 25, 26 minutes, and ended up about 23 minutes. So you were always chopping. But I suppose that wasn't all bad because you're trying to appeal to a much wider audience than just the enthusiast. So if it's moving fast and it's cutting tight and everything else, it probably makes it a bit more spectacular to the average Joe Soap, you know.
The tight cuts and the edit is the thing that really sticks out to us, and specifically with the TV broadcast, which just it's left an impression on us that I suppose we had to thank you for, but you can't really imagine because the music that was used has just left a mark on us in terms of there were electronic acts really from the dance music scene, the likes of the Chemical Brothers and Chicane and the Orb. How do you feel like, do you ever do you feel that it stood the test of time well when you look at these things now?
Not bad, really. Not bad, because I had a great love for music, great love for popular music. For my sins in my early days, just as a hobby, I used to DJ at a little club here in Belfast, and that gave me a great love for music. But of course, as time moved on, my music became a little bit out of date, and my sons began to choose the music, and other people in RPM began to put in the music, and it moved, I think, for that reason, with the time. But it's great fun, very time consuming, but great fun to cut a piece to a good bit of music, and you were always on the lookout for something in that, you know. So yeah, great fun. Yeah,
there's actually a piece in the opening titles for the TV broadcast where I think there's a guy doing the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 countdown up, I think, in Hillsborough at the start of the Circuit of Ireland, and it's just cut in with Hey Boy, Hey Girl by the Chemical Brothers. Mm. And the suspense that builds, we put it up and we shared it amongst a group of us there lately, and we're all of the same opinion that you just can't take your eyes off the TV for the next half an hour because it's just drawing you in straight away.
Yeah. But I mean, you get little lines in a song like "Stones in the Road," for example, which comes to mind, and you're searching for the shot. And I can remember the shot where we actually used that. It was where you turn off the Knockalla stage onto the little narrow road, and this was a down the field car. But he just came around the corner. I think it was front wheel drive, and he churned up this huge, great stone, and it was just perfect for that shot, you know. And so you were looking out for things like that, you know.
Yeah, and another thing was obviously the Saturday of that rally was remarkably wet for Donegal, and I think the music was, the track he used was "Little Fluffy Clouds," and there was nothing little or fluffy, they all seemed to be dark. I suppose, what was the standout memory you would take from Donegal 99?
Undoubtedly, the emotion in Cullen and Ellen Morgan's win. I was lucky enough to record their previous win 8 years before, and you know, the emotion in their faces. And of course, this time round it was very different. I don't know if anybody knew really how ill Ellen was at the time. I don't know if she even knew herself really, but It was an end of a fantastic rallying partnership. It was coming to an end. And the sheer joy of those two people outside Mount Errigal. And of course, Donegal, nowhere does it better, the finish. The whole town comes out, you know, and every driver across the finish line is given the credit. I used to do the commentary with all the 120, 130 cars going past. And it's good because you get to know them all. But everybody got equal bill, and the town and their uncles and aunties and everybody were there, you know. And there was Cullen, the first man from Donegal ever to win the rally twice. And it was so much to him because he's not a rich man, far from it. And the sacrifices that he had made to get that, and all the local people who supported him, Tony Kelly Cars, the Four Lanterns, all those people, it meant so much to them, you know. And it was just it was a wonderful memory and a lovely thing to be part of.
Popular than this one. James Cullen has fulfilled his dream of becoming the first Donegal driver to win the Shell Donegal International Rally twice. Ellen Morgan.
Very lucky that year that Kelly got his hands on Freddie Dorr's car, out of ProDrive. Beautiful car, straight from ProDrive to Kenny. And we just got first dabs on it, I think. So this was the chance, and we had to make the deal happen. And Kenny was very helpful. He wanted it to happen as well. So it meant, you know, it fitted into the budget that we could race. And then we did the one to do a shakedown event, which then turned out to be Cavan, which was ideal before Donegal. And then that tied in with a good friend and supporter, Vincey Whelan, Drifter Shoes. He's obviously a huge rally guy, and, you know, done the Cavan rally for years and years. And so I decided to go there. And then Rory came on board for that one again, because it was easier just to do it. It was all about budget, really, and Sabe Ellen having to come over. And, like, we've been friends. We started rallying, 20-something years, but I don't know, 79 together. And it was really nice to go and have a chance to go and do another rally again. Like, you know, we're one of your good friends. And, you know, so we talked rallying every time we met, and we're from the same area of the town and all that sort of thing. But, so off we went, and Kenny's car to there. So it was proper budget rally. We Saturday morning we left here, got the breakfast in Cavan, signed on to the recce, got a bite to eat on the way home. Left here Sunday morning, bright and early. The rally sits on down the road in the car, all down to sign on and into the car, and off we went. And always remember that Kenny was standing at the end of the first stage after the 3-2-1 boards, just in there, you know. And we were catching the car in front of us, and then I just remember Kenny's big smile standing on the hedge, you know. And that's one of my memories of the day, like, you know. And lucky enough, then we went on, we won the rally, and everything was good, like. And the next time we smiled was we had a couple of wee things done with the car then to make it sit, you know, to more the way I wanted it. So we did a shakedown and down in mucky sand and gravel before the rally. And just in the last run, like, it came over where the thing ended, big slide on the big doing I have a big smile on me and a big smile on Kenny's face and the thumbs up, and that's it. Put the car away, put her on the Twitter, let's go, Joe, let's go, we'll do the rally. So we started on a right, very, very positive attitude, and the car just felt so good.
Must have been interesting as well to have someone who wasn't very, someone who was very familiar with Impreza 555 sitting in with you on that rally too.
Well, Rory, sure, I've been sitting with Bertie all, you know, all the year, so there wasn't much he didn't know about them, like, you know. But he had with credit to him, he came down and had to get used to my notes, and my distances are they're notional distances, they're accurate, but they're not what the words say, like. But anyway, it was good fun, because, like, we could ask them some questions, and we'd have great old rapport anyway, like, if there's no secrets or nothing like that, like. But at the same time, you didn't want to give too much away to Bertie either, or you could go, but you still wanted to win the rally, like, you know. But I think Bertie was out watching actually that as well, so it was good crack afterwards, you know, and between that and Donegal and the wind up and the crack and all that, you know. So, and so that's part of it.
Absolutely. And obviously Donegal, biggest weekend of the rallying year in Ireland, and hometown event, you know. You've been clerk of the course, and you were keen to get a second crack at winning it again. But who did you see as the biggest threat for that weekend and
the hype? Well, luckily enough, you're the hometown boy at the end of the day, and like, you're synonymous with Donegal, have done everything there is to do in it. And then, like, with Rory, we were sitting with Bertie, and then Andrew Nesbitt had got a Cousin de France run to go then, like, and he had a proper 555 car, like, and it was fairly decent top. I was seven, so Eamon Bolton was in front of me, and the black, wasn't it? I think it was the black.
The Hertz car,
Four rally car that year, the Hertz car, like, and so there was, like, there was, you know, seven or eight guys who could actually won the rally in the end up, but I'd say the real times were going to come from three. And, they're going to be, you couldn't give anything away, like, you know, as it turned out, but sure, you can never predict anything in rally, as it turned out in the first stage. Everything was thrown. Ian Greer was there as well, that's right, like, and he was leading the championship, and Ian led the rally for a while, and, you know, I think everybody, all the top drivers in the country were at the one rally and the one time, and fairly all good cars. Like, Frank was there, do you remember, Frank Maher in the The world car that in that, you know, so Frank was third that year, wasn't he?
Second to you.
Second. I knew he was in there somewhere. I mean, no, you know what? And so that was one of the best entries we had in years. And the course, the hype was huge. Like, it always isn't only gone, but when you're from here, sure, it's a home Premiership Cup final match, isn't it? That's what it is.
It's the biggest event of the year, but as you just alluded to, stage one, and you couldn't make it up with the drama, and you were at the center of it. It was happening all over the place.
You know, just as you're talking about it now, you start to remember little bits about it. Like, you know, we were catching Eamon on the first stage, and you just do one of them things you always say you never do, is look at the car. And I just looked at the wrong time, but there was it's like a flat right-hander, and on the recce, it was a very, very fast place, but it was blind, but you had to, you know, you couldn't cross the road. But of course, when you're on the stage, you're on the other side of the road, and it was just a wee bit tight to the thing, and just heard the nip, you know, and didn't see nothing, and of course, no distance, you knew the wheel was going down. So you can imagine that, like, this is, here we go again, like, all the, you know, this is another, as we would say in Donegal, another Hanlon. So we're battling up the stage, and the tire was down, and the noise, and the whole thing. And up the stage, junction left, and here was Nesbitt stuck in the drain. Everybody flagging down. I think he might have got right after me or something. I don't know. Down to the end of the stage, then, and sure, all we were concerned about was getting the wheel changed, see how much time we lost, and we were fairly well down. And then, sure, all the other drama kicked off. Then, we're next thing, they wanted to weigh us, and we wanted to just change the bloody wheel. You know, and all this, you know, that you can imagine coming off the stage, first stage, and the hype and the tension, the whole thing. And then these guys were out with these weight things in the middle of the road, like, you with three wheels on your wagon, like, and just getting up, get back. Anyway, but it turned out we were grand, but Query and kind of fell foul of that, didn't he? And then that kicked off the other drama for the rest of the rally as well, like.
Like, what was going through your mind really after that? Because I suppose you'd lost the guts of a minute or more.
A minute and a half, I think we lost or something like that. I can't remember. A minute and a half. Don't know. You can't give a minute and a half away in that game now. But the quality of the field was as such. You know, Andrew was out of the equation. We were kind of out of the equation. You were just kind of got, you know, you were down in the dumps, like, and that was it. So. There was nothing left to do then. Once you got the thing fixed up, you just drove for a bit of pride. And it's still Friday, like, unless, you know. Usually we were always at the wrong end of things going wrong. It was always us had the problem about it. And I said, okay, it's only one stage gone. Like, what do? We just go as hard as we can go now for as long as we can to see what happened. And we'd done that in one of the other years as well. We had a problem in the first stage, but we end up third. So off we went, then I think we're fast as them on the rest of the stages for the day. Like, so, but we still needed a lot to happen, like, you know, and then obviously things did happen. But.
Like, having someone like Ellen beside you must have played a big role that morning, you know, in motivating you from what really was a low point at the very start of the rally.
You can imagine, as far, all the hopes, everything's really, really high. The expectations, we had a great shakedown in the car. We knew the car was excellent. We had all the ducks in a row this time. We had everything go, you know, we weren't the underdog anymore, if you know what I mean, as much. We had the car the same as everybody else, properly run, everything. So the expectations were high. And then all of a sudden, like, and then it was my, you know, I made the mistake. So me, you know, it doesn't matter how it happened. It's your own fault, you made the, for whatever reason. So as I say, you know, we had been there before, and that was, and Ellen reminded us of that. We did it with the problem in 90 before we won the rally. Turbo went in the first stage, lost a pile of time, and then we went and set 13 fastest stage times in a row. So it wasn't just Ellen, was a real, with a real, there was a good team. You know, it's not just one person. The other, like, two, George was there, and Brother Joe does the tires, and all, you know, all the guys and sponsors have been with us for years. And Alan Causey, who would have run the Escort for years, was over, along with, you know, Kenny's guys to do the thing. And then, of course, sure, you had Kenny himself, like, so, you know, we had a very good package, but we didn't know where we were going to find a minute and a half on him. But so off we went. hell for leather, and us, all we could do was go for it. And that's what we did then for the Friday. Saturday is a different ball game now. But...
Like Friday, obviously, like you alluded to yourself, their number of fastest times and, you know, gathered back a bit of the time loss. Saturday was a completely different day. Very wet. Mm. And Bertie and Ian Greer were having a huge fright out the front. What was your approach, you know, with the conditions as well and that fight distance?
It would be unusual for Donegal, but it actually was a deluge and there was like lots of standing water on the roads. There were very, very wet stages, even though the grip level down there is still very good. The race was still all at the front. All thirds, you know, and while that sort of a battle is on, still two big days in Donegal. So it's never over, as I say, till it's over. So it was kind of dictated then by where we were, what we had. The gap we had to close, the conditions, and we kind of thought, right, this is a day 95, you know, as hard as you can go, but you cannot afford to make another mistake, so you must stay in the road. And we picked everything accordingly. And what what influenced it was George had a set of secondhand wets that he'd used in a rally. They were in fairly good shape, but all the good, you know, so they were free. So they went on Saturday morning and we said, right, we'll give it a bit of a go in Glen here and see. And we're joint quickest in Glen and that. So I was happy enough with that. Then we'll go on the, we'll try and measure this. Like the quickest tire would be an intermediate, but you would be sticking your neck out a few wee bits. Like, but if you needed it, like, and Bertie proved that he was quickest the next one and dry because it wasn't holding as much water and was better. And that's the way it went then until poor Bertie got down it. And he clipped a wee stone. He did what I did on Friday. And when he got a puncher and then went up and just didn't get stopped for the next right-hander after it. Like, so that was like another one gone. And then all of a sudden, you just never know. So we battled on as best we could then on Saturday. Was a really wet day, so it was good and easy in the car, and I enjoyed it now. And like, I don't know if we end up leading Saturday night or not.
Yeah, like Ian was obviously left out front with Bertie off the road in Kindrum, so you, like, Ian would have done the rally a few times. You must have been confident of catching him though at that stage.
Well, I suppose he had a lot on his mind from the problems earlier in the rally, then his fight with Bertie, then that was for the championship. So all of a sudden, if he won his appeal, he could have been leading the championship. And I may not have been his first priority to be fastest. Like, and we had the butt between our teeth then. Like, and once Bertie went off, like, we were just, it was back on again. So we just went for it. Like, and then everything fell, you know, everything started to fall into place for us then. So that was, and that was early, fairly early on Saturday, I think. So, you know, I think we must have led the rally the week. You know, everything, and the plan was there, and it was ours to lose then at that stage, and we just had a plan then to go as quick as you had to go just for the rest of the rally.
Ian Salika was a car that you were to become a bit more familiar with a year or two down the line, because subsequently that became George's car. And I suppose just because of this being obviously, for us, we always found this as a special rally, Donegal 99, because it was kind of the last rally of the real Group A cars before the World cars really came on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're in a unique position because you've driven three of the most iconic Group A cars. How did the three cars compare?
There's three different cars in many ways. The thing we suffered with the Escort was it didn't have the proper box and it didn't have the front, you know, the big front diff on it, so it left it a wee bit. You had to be careful with it, like, but it had everything else, and it was a comfortable car to drive. And you know, you're brought up as a Ford Motorsport person. It was obviously nice to drive one, and the car was good to us. Kenny Subaru, the 555 car, the Impreza. I would describe it as people at the time. It did exactly what I said in the time. It did everything well. once you get into the car, driving position was great. You could see out of the car properly. It stopped rail, it turned in, it handbraked, it did everything that you wanted to do, like very comfortable car to drive. You could drive it like a Mark II Escort if you wanted. You could, you know, and it just did exactly what it said in the tin. It was a lovely, lovely car to drive. Very easy to drive, very easy to catch by the scruff of the neck and wring its neck, like, and still feel comfortable. You know, it never felt like it was going to bite you back. Supercar, I have to say. And I was lucky enough to get George's, that Celica down in, Slieve Mon, is it down in, where Frank got arrested? I used to go to.
Not far from here, actually, yeah.
I used to go to test and all that sort of thing, like, and George would be down. And the only sad thing about that, or regret, or I didn't get to do a rally in it, but we spent, we must have been half a day down in the place, like, you know. Up and down, now that was the quickest car ever. It definitely was the quickest car. Now, once you get used to the big bonnet, the big long bonnet, and you could, you know, you had to kind of left foot brake it a bit and the tighter stuff, but it was a very impressive car. Jesus, it definitely could cover ground. Now, it was definitely off all and by far the quickest car. But everything moves on too, Tommy. I suppose, like, the Escort was back in, you know, relieving out of, I suppose, 96, 97 was the end of that Escort era, wasn't it? And the Legacy, you know, Ford went to four-wheel drive, obviously, and then the Legacy and the Impreza came along, and you had the 1.65 Toyota, and then the 205 now, but I was good to drive. I know it was good to have a chance to drive them all.
You alluded it to there, going into the final day, you had a manageable cushion of about 48 seconds. You had some quick guys behind you, the likes of Frank Maher was still there, you know, in second. What way did you feel about managing the lead at that stage?
Well, our pass record, Donegal, and things going wrong, we'd been fairly nervous about it now, to be honest with you. It was down in Inishowen, which had been, like, you had Malin Head, which is an absolute class every stage. And when you get to a classic, they're easy to drive. You just drive naturally and good. And the times come, the other ones are a wee bit more difficult, you know, because they're not working as flow in the stages. Like, but all we had to do was, like, you know, barring making a mistake, nobody was going to take 48 seconds. Obviously, like, and we, as I say, Saturday evening, we could have went quicker and we could have upped the pace at any stage, really. But that stage was about doing what you're supposed to do and finish the rally, like, and then hopefully get the one. And, you know, we was up to the last stage, we're still nervous. And then, you know, Malin Head was a wee bit difficult because it's such a great stage. Like, and I got the, but not telling off, but I just went through the things beforehand, like where you are, what the gap is. And, you know, there's no need to put on a show out here. But sure, you couldn't do Malin Head not put on a show. So I said, okay, I'll behave myself another two, but I have to drive this because it's just, anyone that has done it will know what I'm talking about. It's like Cod's Head in Killarney. It's just, it's a cracker of a stage, like, so.
Well, I suppose it's nice to, you know, end a rally like that with something pure enjoyment driving, really, you know, to get let off the lead at least for.
But a wee bit, like, you know, so, but I mean, it was the most important thing was to get it back home for everybody's sake, like, you know.
As you said, for everybody's sake, because you were always known for running on a budget, and this was, you know, a chance to be obviously on an equal footing, and you were getting the best car. Like, how dependent were you on your backers, you know, that year to get out for the
ball? Well, you know, I'm very lucky to have the backing I had locally, and I've had it for, like, you go to Tony Kelly, he's been there since he started his business in 81 right through. Frank Brines, who's not with us anymore, the Four Lanterns, and every rally person early knows the Four Lanterns. So Frank's a great rally fan, loved coming to the rallies, and I was lucky enough that I was the person who, one of the main people he backed. But Frank's generosity was known everywhere, like, and he was a very astute businessman as well, and big interest in football, and supported the rally, supported other rally drivers, supported lots and lots of football clubs, and lots, you know, one of those really good guys who it was a privilege and a pleasure to know. And as I said earlier, Vincent Whelan from Drifters and Wrangler, it was Wrangler Shoes. You know, they were the three main. And then we were lucky enough to have met David Thomas, who had been the Shell Motorsport guy, who were on Jimmy McRae, Colin, all the Shell Gemini program, Bertie Fisher and Hudson Boner, all. And David liked what we did as well. So, you know, that would be our main four backers. And then, we had the Buckler thing and we had the Yorkie thing, and that was through friends of friends who made contacts with these people. And but basically our foundation was we're all local guys, like, and so they're all rally people, like, and the one meant as much to them as it did to us. Like, you know, the one Donegal is always special, and even, like, you know, especially coming from Donegal, it doesn't matter where you come, if you're rallying in Ireland, one of the rallies you want to win is Donegal. So,
did this win in comparison? How does it compare to the win in 1991, and how special was it to Ellen? Because I know that you still have the notes from 99 above.
Right. Well, if you say so, I'll agree with that. They're in a box somewhere. I have. I knew you were looking at what you the last time you were here. Like, but no, there's boxes of stuff from Clarny, different. Not a lot. Now, they kept some of the Donegal ones and some of the Clarny ones. That's for sure now. But, like, I suppose nothing beats your first one. And then, you know, when you have so many years where you could have won it, and didn't, then you know definitely to get another one, you know, it's another, you know, that sort of thing, you know, will I ever want it again? Time slipping on, and we're probably very lucky. It was nice. 99 was great to win, actually, because all your peers were there, all the guys you respected, and all the guys who were the best of the best were in Donegal that year, and we won the rally, and that, and the following year, like that. But you wouldn't only want it the following year in a Group A car. That's 99 was the end of that era. We needed, like, so the steamroller came then with the P2000 arrived, like, and that was just so much quicker than a 96 car, like, it was 4 years farther on. So, and the budget just doubled. So, you know, it was great, actually, when you think back at it now, and thinking about it, like, we needed the next step for 2000 on. So, that was us then, as well, as we did deal out at that stage. So.
Have you any interesting tales from the event in 99 that, I suppose, never really came to light until, you know, maybe now?
Well, part of it's the hype, like, lucky enough, it was one of the rallies there were no dramas before, and normally there's always a drama here, some kind or other, like, you know. No, it's just... you know, to want it again with all the guys, like, and all the memories, that's the big thing. And the fact that there's a lot of people involved that year, you know, there's a number of them not with us now. There's a lot of people who we competed against, obviously, who are not with us now. So that is definitely a very, very special year.
And your lasting memory of that rally?
The end of this, I think there'd be a number. The downside of what happened on Friday, like, you know, you put so much into someone, as you know, you're certainly well deflated. Like, you know, the wet in Donegal on Saturday was class. Like, you had to go, you were going for it. Things were going your way. Proper car that loved the wet, I enjoyed driving in the wet, that responded in the wet. It was just that good a car, and you just, you know, that to me is everything of why you go and want to be a rally driver. It would have been the Saturday and only golf Sunday, you had to just, you know, yeah, they just finish it, like, but the Saturday in the wet and Donegal is as good as it gets, like, it really was.
Quite good to hear from yourself that it means this rally meant as much to you in terms of being able to compete against all your peers from, you know, your years of rallying and to be there in equal machinery, because the reason we've picked this episode this rally to focus this episode on was simply because that's what really stood out to us about this rally. It was the one time that we got to see you in a 555 Frank Maher in a World Car, Bertie in a 555, all Austin was there in the Sadiqa, Ian Greer was there in Sadiqa, all the guys at the top of their game in the best machinery. You know, it was the last chance we'd seen a real shootout between all you guys.
I think it's one of the few rallies that there were as many. There are always three or four, but there were seven or eight in that rally that actually could have won the rally. And as it turned out, it's the end of the Group A era, wasn't it? You know, because then 2000, Bertie didn't go. Then Andrew moved into the P2000, and the World Cars started to come when Derek had won. Derek McGarry had won. You know, therefore, then a Group A car was second division. Then it wasn't going to happen anymore. So I suppose that was the last of the time that a Group A car could have won an international rally. So it was nice to do that, actually, now to think of it. So, but definitely a P2000 and a World Car wasn't going to be in our calendar anyway, or within our budget. So
the main thing to take away from it was that at the end of all the stages in Donegal for 3 days, the winner was James Cullen, navigated by Ellen Morgan. And even now, I'm sure that still sounds good.
Of course, it sounds good. Like, it wasn't that many, and it was great. As I say, it's full of great memories. Kenny was there running the team, and Kenny was a guy who everyone I admired. And it's another guy who's capable of winning the rally if he had been there. And you had him in your corner as well. There are so many great things about it. But as I say, sure, nothing beats winning. That's nothing beats it.
So that was the story of Donegal 99, as told by two people who were most heavily involved in it. Guys, to summarise it, I guess, we always ask this question, does it live up to the kind of hype we've afforded it now?
It lives up to it fully. The Saturday, especially. Saturday is, it's moving day in Donegal anyway on the leaderboard. But, the way it chopped and changed on that Saturday, and how Cullen ended up at the end of the day in front in command, was as mad a day, I'd say, as there's been in Irish rallying in a long time. Between retirements and fellas going back and fellas hitting the car, bad weather. I was at Donegal that year watching in 1999. The Saturday, up on the top of Hyde Lane, was as bad as bits of Rally Ireland in 09 for the weather. It was biblically bad at times. And by the end of the day, the sun was shining and Cullen was in the lead. It was just a mad, mad, mad day.
If you look at the performances, I suppose, of Nisbet and Cullen, Nisbet had obviously lost a good shot more time with his off, but he had fastest times for the rest of the event, and Cullen had seven. And Cullen, he managed to claw back all the time by Saturday night. He was leading and going into Sunday, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was leading, and Greer, who had been leading, was in third at the end of the day. Maher had got up to second. Fisher was out. McHale was back to field. McGarrity was out. That Saturday in particular was a mad day.
That sequence of lane was fantastic to watch, because it was running downhill or just over the crest down into the village, we'll say, and there was no bales.
Yeah,
it was one of the last times they ran it like that.
That shot when they're coming into lane or going out at lane over that left hander as they're coming in, or right hander as they're going out, with a bit of a rise on it.
Yeah,
a super corner, and that's what I was kind of saying, way back there at the start, that this was kind of the last year some of these ran in an unaltered format, because the cars just weren't quick enough to necessitate that yet.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there in terms of the Saturday was where the really sorted out the men from the boys, and the cream really rose to the top. There was a very close battle at the front with Ian Greer and Bertie swapping times all day, but when you look at it, James Cullen winning the rally was an amazing feat. And like the two feats of the rally were obviously Nesbitt's comeback and James winning. But when you weigh it up, James was in a hire car. That basically they gathered as much as they could locally to get this, to make it happen. You can be damn sure they didn't have the same pick of tires. They'd had a budget for tires. This is, and that's no aside against Andrew Nesbitt.
Sure. James said himself he was using secondhand tires that his brother had.
Yeah, George had a set left over.
Do you know what I mean? So that, like, that'll tell you, like.
And that's the, like, it was probably perfect that it was wet for him on Saturday, you know, where you could maybe make a set of wets last for two loops rather than burning a set of slicks off the oak in one loop if it had been dry.
Yeah, it's easier in the car as well once you don't go off. That sort of stuff. But again, it allows the, you know, some of the real natural car, guys with the superb car control, like Frank as well, you know, to get the times in as well, you know.
A very science-style performance by Frank.
He was, yeah. But I think one sequence, you know, you have those little bits of footage from rallies gone by that always stick in your head. One that sticks in my head from since then is Frank on one of the Sunday stages, possibly Malham, one of the junctions of Malham, coming down into it. The escort is popping and banging and whistling and flies out through kind of a quick left junction, changes up, does a crack from the upshift and off the own, and there's no voiceover, and it's just pure car.
It's the fast square left at the school.
It's just pure audio and action. Oh, it's iconic, like, isn't it?
So good.
That kind of brings us on to, I suppose, a slightly sad point that an awful lot of the guys that we're looking at here and even on the intro list aren't with us anymore. You know, and it doesn't seem like all that long ago, but it's 22 years ago now, which is kind of, it doesn't feel like that long ago, it sure doesn't.
No,
like, it really doesn't. Like, and I suppose that this is the same for people as they get older. When stuff is in living memory, and you remember it happening, and you remember being there, it never seems like it's that long ago because you were there and you experienced it. That's why I suppose, you know, people like us have such a fascination with Group B and all of that, because we were never around. I'm sure people who experienced it feel like we do about this, you know, because they can remember it.
It doesn't diminish it by any means, though, because in fact it probably makes it even more close to our hearts, I think, and I'm sure the same for a lot of other people as well.
I think you hit the nail on the head before, Mars, when you talked about, you know, these are your very impressionable formative years. Like, I'd say we were all, say three of us were aged between 10 and 14 at the time. You talk about this, whether it stands the test of time. When you think about the videos that you look at on YouTube, you know, and occasionally you pick one to stream through Chromecast, Donegal 99 is nearly always a really safe bet that, you know, do you know what I fancy? I'm going to pull this down here and watch this now. And there was just, it was things even in it that would say, the rally wasn't actually separated out into international and national at that stage. So even the TV coverage reflected that. And RPM had the section called the Class Acts. And great action all the way down through the field before they got their own TV program. The clubmen, the local guys, boys in micras, throwing them into ditches, and half the country helping digging them back out of it. But there's bits in it there, like, say, there was, like, F2. It never really took hold here in Ireland, but, I mean, we'd guys there like Niall McShea came along to do the rally, as mentioned, absolutely on a mission while the car lasted. And Ollie O'Donovan won it in, I think, an ex-McKinstry Escort. But it was something that stood out to me. Was, did anyone spot when the ex-Nissan Motorsports Europe Sonny broke down?
Was something Michael Murray, wasn't it?
Michael Murray.
Some fuck here? Of a child laughing at it.
The little bastard, he thought he was like Nelson from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
That's one of the things from that event that
you'd
I kind
be getting
of,
a clip of the extinguisher if he was near me.
Yeah, he'd be getting pegged out of it. But even you look at, there were stories like of, you talk about guys who are no longer around, Sammy Fisher in the Mini, and, you know, unfortunately the late Mark Fisher, you know, who won Group N and finished 10th overall, and, you know, his first time in a Group N car. And even the guy in the Swift coming over the finish ramp, like, it's real
Just looking there, Joe McGurk as well, another man who's gone as well. Yeah. There, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure, like, just as I said, there's so many people that have unfortunately passed away since. But
like, for me, like, a major thing from this rally, sorry not to call across, but I think why it kind of hits for us as well is that the guys that finished first and second were always the underdogs. They were always the guys who were trying to pull the budget together, who had the talent, sometimes had the care, but never quite the budget sometimes to run it. And the ultimate rally in Ireland, those were the two boys that finished first and second.
It was nice to see that, you're right, Tommy. Like, and if things had gone slightly differently for Frank, he could have won if Cullen had lost more time with the puncher or whatever. So Frank, to my best of my knowledge, he never won Donegal, sure, didn't.
I think it was the only Irish international. He didn't win the Ulster, but I think it was the only other Irish international he didn't win. I think he won Killarney, he won Cork, won Galway. Yeah.
Won the Manx even, like something.
Won the Manx even, yeah.
Unfortunately defeated Bertie. As close as he got.
People like often reference the likes of, say, Frank's drive in Galway against Mark Lovell as being one of the great drives, and it was. But in 1991, Frank went and raced James Cullen in a Sierra Cosworth in Donegal on his first attempt in Donegal. He was second going into the final day ahead of the likes of Jimmy McRae, also in a Sierra Cosworth. You know, like, this kind of was the really a great showcase of how the likes of James Cullen and Frank Maher, when they had the right machinery, they could really give it to the guys that, you know, they'd been chasing all these years, you know. And that's a big takeaway from this rally for me, I think. And like, the coverage, the music is everything. And like, we see it, like, RPM has helped form our musical tastes as well as our insane perversion for Group A 555.
I was only thinking this the other day, you know, if this was, you know, what was the thing that used to be on Sky Sports? The rally, was it Rally Live?
Rally World.
Like, if the only coverage we had of Irish rallying was Rally World, you know, with your man
Andrew South Marriott. And,
yeah, like, but which was grand.
Like, Captain Wrong.
It wouldn't have been anywhere near as good. So, well, what it did was the coverage made a really good event even better. Like, it was, and you alluded to it way back at the start, Tommy. RPM were at the peak of their powers here, where they could tell everything in one episode, and yeah, things changed a bit afterwards when they had to split it into two and, you know, dilute it down a bit, and then, you know, they had to focus on more guys with more World Rally cars who had more money and all wanted a bit of coverage. You know, this is kind of the last year you could probably tell a really good story throughout the whole thing as well.
Yeah, like, Austin barely featured in this program.
He didn't have to. You know, that was the thing.
They struggled to fit everyone in, I think, because there was so much going on. Like, the amount of fan cam footage that they had to use, because there was so much happening.
Yeah. That was fan cam footage in, you know, 99, like. And we're still getting it. That was
on RPM as well. We had little fluffy clouds by the orb, and I think Lenny Kravitz tune as well playing. I mean, you know,
whatever the remix of that song at the end is, a little bit of history repeating. You're a woman with the kind of soul voice, but it's like it's got a drum and bass beat under it, showing the flashback of James winning in 1991, and now he's winning again. History's repeating and all of that. Because that's actually 1991 Donegal is the RPM archive upload this week on the Motorsport Ireland channel.
Excellent.
Which is fairly, because what, it's 30 years now since he won it first.
There's
a bit in that footage that I love. I think the stage is Pluck. He's coming out of a square, I think it's square right down the hill, and he gives it the boot and the pink's ear, the way it just bites for grip. Down all that power, and it's a flat straight. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's the 92 event as well, is well worth the watch. There's the bit from Fisher, Dean Cairn, the legacy in Nacala, still one of my favourite bits of RPM footage as well. So, well worth checking out. It's just worth noting, I guess, guys, before we wrap it up, where this left the championship and stuff. And the championship itself was in no small amount of turmoil at the time.
No, you had, I think, already no Circuit of Ireland the following year. as it turned out, the following year, you would also have Galway.
No, Galway did a release. Did thought already it was moving to sometime in late summer, probably around the
end
of summer. No Ulster, because of the Tony Gardemeister incident.
And no Ulster, and they ran a weird little challenge 2000 rally instead to like try new spectator safety things. So the 2000 championship, while again has a couple of very high points in terms of a championship, was quite weak.
Yeah,
like it didn't start until Killarney and the Maybank Holiday weekend, you know. They had to shoehorn the Summit 2000 rally into it to make it work. There was no championship at all in 2001. So it was 2002 before it was arguably 2004 before things got back to normal, because that was the next time Galway would run in February.
Yeah, exactly.
1999 was a dangerous time to be watching rally on television in Southern Ireland, because it was on TV3 and the reception could be so dodgy you'd have to send the old boy up on the ladder to try and move it or something, you know. What was he doing on the bloody roof?
Do you remember the crack, you know, when you'd have to record on tape at the time, but you'd have to tune the VCR as well?
Yeah.
Video plus used to be very trustworthy either at times at the time.
It's amazing how the mind just blots all this hardship out as well, isn't it?
And it was bloody hardship, like, just,
we don't miss it at the time.
Get a bit of it.
What are you on about? I've been fishing through boxes of VHS tapes for the last fortnight and for this.
I still haven't found it.
Yeah. I suppose another thing to remember, we alluded to, you know, people that, you know, sadly are no longer with us. It would be remiss of us to overlook the role Ellen Morgan played in James Cullen's successes over the years. And it was kind of fitting, I suppose, that he'd win the last one with her too, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Good point. I think just on the championship that year, then Ian Greer would actually go on to win the title. He'd won his first international in 98, Cochrane in 98. Mm. Quick guy. And subsequently went on to buy what became Eugene Danby's Corolla, won Luxembourg in 2001, and was going pretty well, and he partly retired. But Ian was a quick man. It's only now when you look back at it, because he wasn't at the top level for all that long. You kind of forget that, Jesus, he was well able to put it up to the lads, wasn't he?
Well, he was a Manta, didn't he?
Yeah, like he was the last man to win the national championship in a two-wheel drive car in 93, the old Brian McGrath, ex-Nesbitt Manta, moved into a Celica then, and was always, you know, knocking about, could put in some good times, always seemed to be able to pull good sponsorship from places. I still remember, like, he had KFC on the car, you know, back in the day, or, you know, he had, you know, Texaco and stuff like that. He always had some good sponsors. Yeah.
It's a lovely looking car, the Toronto DePaul Celica, as well, isn't it?
It really was, yeah. And then when he kind of started to hit his stride with the Celicas, I remember he won Mayo, I think maybe 2 years in a row. And the pace was definitely there. You know, he'd be leading the Circuit of Ireland after three or four stages and might trail off. Yeah. And it was just a case of him getting it all together. And you look at, we mentioned at the start, you know, the Imprezas, you know, were still doing the business. Arguably, if a quicker driver had got into a 205 sooner, they probably would have been the machine to beat, as long as they weren't running that weird super strut suspension.
I
don't think he was running it.
I think you could run the ST185 suspension in the car. It was actually reverse compatible and was modified with both, I think.
He was supremely quick and just seemed to have found a turn of speed that year and was able to keep going with it. And ironically, the fact he was excluded from Donegal in the end up on a technicality, the car had been underweight, didn't matter. His results on the rest of the rounds were strong enough and he was able to take a championship, his only championship.
Yeah.
And in that kind of year at the start of it, I don't think anyone would have put Greer as a person who would win it fairly dominantly. I think with two wins, he won in Cork, he won in Killarney. And could afford to drop Donegal by being excluded. So it was quite a year for him.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so that pretty much wraps us up, guys. It's been very interesting to look back at, as I said, one of the all-time classic Irish rallies. My personal favourite RPM programme anyway, for without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah.
They're all great around this era, but that one was just, it had everything, I think.
I think having someone like James Cullen as the winner too, it does sweeten it a little bit, yeah. You know.
Yeah, like awesome. they could have made a whole. There's probably an hour long documentary on the Saturday alone.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, so like for them to make the show, what is it, 35 or 40 minutes or whatever it was?
Yeah,
and to get everything into it, like it doesn't stop for a minute. Like there's none of the usual kind of preamble at the start. It pretty much gets straight into it because there's so much to cover that year.
Relentless. It's absolutely relentless as a show, because, and I think that's probably why it captured our imagination. They used the right music, and that captured the same energy, but everything was happening so much, you know.
As I said at the start, this episode is coming out on what is usually the Friday morning of Donegal, when everyone is at fever pitch for the event. So hopefully this goes some small way towards alleviating the sadness this year about it not running, but hopefully we'll be back there once again next year to enjoy it again. So thanks very much to the Plum Tindall and James Cullen for coming on and chatting to us. Great stories from the lads as usual. So cheers to them for doing that. And thanks to Tommy and Art for coming on and reminiscing.
Yeah, I'll have that.
So
like old men though.
Old men, Jesus. I remember, well, actually on the old men point, right? If you look at 99, go back 20 years from 99. And what car won the world championship that year? What driver?
Bjorn Valdegaard.
79 Valdegaard in the Mark II. He's the first, exactly. First time the world championship ran that as a world championship.
And this is 22 years ago now. So, you know, we're further on now than 79 was to 99. You know what I'm saying? So, again,
yeah, we'll have to think of a Donegal 99 international sponsor for the podcast. You know, we did this for the 2000.
I'm just going to go with Shell. No, I'm going to go with Shell because Shell is gone out of the country. I know there's reasons for that. But yeah. Shell and Donegal, they just, you know, the old stickers. I remember Joey.
Not popular with the Rossport listeners, Mars.
Absolutely not. But just for the purposes of this particular episode, yeah. Right, we'll to Shell Donegal that they can have it because when we were being a kid and seeing if you saw a Donegal sticker on a car, it seemed almost exotic, you know, because it was so far away and I didn't get to Donegal for a good few years. So, you know, it was like a different world. It was such a fucking spin back then. So there was no motorways in the country in 99.
I expected to be able to get Shell Donegal stickers in my local Shell petrol station when I was a child because that's how closely you associate with them.
Yeah.
Pulse would be my personal backer.
You go for Pulse. I go for Donegal. I go for Donegal Express. Michael used to have them on the car for just the Donegal rally only. They were like a courier transport thing in Donegal, and it was always in a really weird place on the car because his livery was set. It was like Castrol, and then somewhere like along the bottom of the door or something. I mean, this Donegal Express thing,
40-degree angle or something.
Yeah, so I go Donegal Express. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Nice,
right.
And obscure.
Cool. Yeah, so that brings us into land as such. Landing like Don Buckley Don Buckley's Porsche off Legland Bridge. It was an awful landing. Good luck. So thanks again for listening, and we'll be back again soon with another episode. So talk to you soon.
Remember to like and subscribe to the Sprint Podcast, and, of course, keep the revs up.